Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. In the late 1820s and throughout the 1830s and really even through today, the term Indian removal has been used to verbally soften a set of harsh U.S. policies to deport entire populations of Native people in the Deep South, in states like Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. It was done to take some of the most fertile land, this policy, in the world at the time, and it was also done in order to expand slavery. Today we are going to be in conversation about this history. My guest is Claudio Sont. He is the author of the book Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. He was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2020 and winner of the Bancroft Prize in 2021. He is also the Richard B. Russell Professor in American History at the University of Georgia. He joins us via Zoom. Claudio Sont, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
It's great to speak with you, Mitch.
You don't use the term Indian removal really in your book. Tell me why.
I don't use the term, and it's astonishing that we have inherited that term and continued to use it for almost 200 years now. That was a term coined by the proponents or advocates of the policy in the 1820s to describe something that was really much more horrendous. So I call it an expulsion, which is historically appropriate. That's what opponents called it at the time. I also call it a deportation occasionally. Some observers from abroad referred to it at the time as a deportation. And then I also refer to it at certain times and places as a policy of extermination. And that too is historically accurate. There were high level officers in the US Army corresponding with each other who explicitly said that the Secretary of War went for a policy of extermination in the case of the Seminoles. But Indian removal, it doesn't capture, as people at the time noted, it doesn't capture the violence that underlay this policy. So I do not use it, as you say.
And it was purposefully used. I mean, that's why I said in my introduction, but I learned that from your book, is that they deliberately used the term Indian removal in order to sort of soften its image.
It was part of a much larger propaganda campaign. We think of propaganda as a 20th and 21st century phenomena, but back in the early 19th century, Andrew Jackson sent out political operatives around the country to promote this policy. He wanted to make this the centerpiece of his administration. And so they wrote opinion pieces and they placed them in newspapers and magazines, and these were printed and reprinted. And they were misleading in all sorts of ways. But the gist, the overall gist of these policies, of this propaganda, was that this was the best thing for the subjects of the policy, that this was the best thing for the victims, that this was a benevolent and philanthropic policy. And so Indian removal, this benign term, was part of that campaign.
You compare what happened to in the 1830s with this deportation of Native people from what we consider today the Deep South. You compare it to other great force mass expulsions in history, even in ancient history, globally. But you also say there's something different that distinguishes what happened in the 1830s from other times.
Yes. So this is probably the most familiar topic in Native American history, and I've been teaching in this field now for almost 30 years. And since it was seemingly so familiar, it wasn't something that I really explored myself in my own research. I was working in other subjects. And so this is my fourth book, but what got me into the subject is that I inherited this, my grandfather's papers, and he escaped from Hungary in 1938 and then continued corresponding with his family in Hungary through 1943, Hungarian Jews were among the last to be deported in the spring of 1944, and they were sent to Auschwitz. So I inherited the correspondence. It was all in Hungarian. I had it translated, read through it, and then started reading some of the historical secondary literature on deportations in the 20th century, and began asking myself, why do we not talk about Indian removal in the same way? Why do we use different language? Why is there a sense of inevitability surrounding this event? Why does the literature talk about it only as a tragedy? It certainly was a tragedy, but there was very little on the massive state bureaucracy and that was built up around it, and on the administration of the event. So I began thinking about it comparatively, but not just comparatively, to draw connections between these later deportations and better known deportations in the 19th century and 20th centuries. And in fact, there are historical connections. There were state administrators in France in the mid-1830s, after the invasion of Algeria, who looked to the United States as a model for what to do with so-called indigenous peoples. And Germans did the same in Southwest Africa in the late 19th century. And then most notoriously, Hitler referred to people in Eastern Europe as native people. He said the Volga River will be our Mississippi. He saw it as a kind of comparative model of expansion, and this time expanding eastward instead of westward, as the United States did. So what is what all of these modern deportations have in common is the massive state bureaucracy and administration that is built up around them, and the desire to create a kind of uniform citizenry. So in which people whom state administrators deemed did not belong would be eliminated in one way or another. So I do think it is one of the first state-sponsored mass deportations in the modern era.
You mentioned the French in Algeria roughly around the same time. This is where we get the word indigenous. It's a French word.
Well, what's interesting about this is that the French were using the word indigène to apply it to native peoples in the Americas long before France invaded Algeria. It's in the 1830s when they begin to apply it to people who live in Algeria. And the reason they apply it, they're calling them indigenous people. The reason they're doing that is that, again, they're looking at the United States as a model for what to do with colonized peoples, how to treat them, how to dispossess them, in essence.
Looking at what happened here in the United States, again, in the Deep South in the 1830s, before that, ever since Europeans arrived to the continent, they've been taking land from Native Americans, Native people. But there is something significant and a shift in U.S. policy in the 1830s. Can you talk to me about that?
Right. Dispossession begins almost from the very first day when Europeans set foot in the Americas. So it is a long and an ugly story. And when the United States was created, George Washington and Adams and Jefferson continued this policy of taking land from Native peoples. But those dispossessions, beginning in 1500 approximately, occurred piecemeal and haphazardly. So dispossession might have occurred at a certain time and place because of the introduction of diseases, or because Native peoples felt too much pressure because of environmental degradation. So they moved westward. Sometimes there were wars sparked by Europeans. So certainly hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres were stolen from Native peoples long before this official policy. I think what's remarkable about this piece of legislation, which is what it is, it's passed by Congress and signed by the president in May of 1830. What's remarkable is that it is the first formal official state policy to, in essence, eliminate every single Native person living within the boundaries of the United States. And that was unprecedented. And it sparked this unprecedented mobilization of the federal government to undertake this mass deportation.
It's really interesting to me when we think about the geographical boundaries of the United States and changing significantly. I think usually we think of the Mexican-American War in 1846, when we basically take half of Mexico and almost grow the United States by almost doubling it, really. And that's what we think about. But in preparing for our conversation, I started thinking also about the 1830s and the Deep South, places, you know, states today like Mississippi, Georgia, you're in Georgia, Alabama. It wasn't so different. I mean, these were before the 1830s, these were, we think of it today as sort of, you know, bastions of conservative white reactionary politics. But these were indigenous lands before the 1830s.
The transformation that took place is really astonishing. In the space of 10 years, in this single decade in the 1830s. So you're absolutely right. We think about the South today as this bastion of conservatism, although that's changing. But when we think of the history, we also think of sprawling slave plantations in the antebellum era. That's accurate, except that we need to remind ourselves that the very heart of what we think of as the Deep South, the Confederacy, the very heart of it, Alabama and Mississippi, 30 years before the outbreak of the Civil War, was Indian country. And so in 1830, fully half of what became the state of Mississippi was still the Choctaw and Chickasaw nations. About a third of Alabama belonged to the Creeks, and the northern fifth of Georgia belonged to the Cherokees. The western edge of North Carolina also belonged to the Cherokees, and the eastern corner of Tennessee. A large chunk of central Florida belonged to the Seminoles. So if you were to look at the South in 1830, it has a huge indigenous presence. Now the number of Native peoples was much smaller than the number of colonists or U.S. citizens. There were about 80,000 indigenous peoples in the 1830s. But again, they had this expansive land base. And so in the space of a decade, these forests, small family farms were razed. The colonists, planters describe cutting down, or rather having enslaved peoples, ordering enslaved peoples to cut down peach trees in central Mississippi that measured an astonishing 18 inches across at the base of the trunk. These were old peach orchards that Creeks and Choctaws and Chickasaws had planted. These were cut down, uprooted, and the land was turned over to cotton cultivation. So tens of thousands of enslaved people were shipped in from the Chesapeake region, and the region was transformed. It's really an astonishing remaking of the demographics as well as the land itself.
Some of the people that we are talking about are the Cherokees, the Creeks, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles. These are called today the five civilized tribes. I want to ask you about that term, five civilized tribes, because it makes me think we're talking about the policy before the 1830s. The United States had a policy I think it was called the civilization policy, and trying to somehow incorporate the native people at the time into sort of this white European American way of life. And that's another significant change that happens with these expulsion policies.
That's right. For the first two or three decades of the country's history, there is this so-called civilization policy. And it's ethnocentric, no doubt about it. Federal agents were sent off to various Indian nations to teach folks how to be Christians, to teach them to read and write in English, to dress like Westerners. Indigenous women who dedicated themselves to farming were supposed to give it up and practice the so-called domestic arts, to have to tend family gardens and to spin cotton fibers into thread and then work on a loom and turn it into homespun textiles. So they were supposed to be like white women. And the men were supposed to give up seasonal hunting and to become farmers and work behind a plow most of the year. So this was the civilization policy. As I say, it's obviously ethnocentric. It was also some cynical, and in the minds of some folks, extraordinarily cynical, because the ultimate goal was simply to get Native peoples to cede their hunting grounds, with the idea that a family farm would be much smaller, 40 acres, say, and then the United States could have the rest of the land. But it wasn't always cynical. There certainly were philanthropists who had convinced themselves that this was the best thing. And the goal then was that these folks would become U.S. citizens eventually. So that policy is overturned with Jackson's effort to dispossess and expel Native Americans. He says, well, it's hopeless to turn these savages into civilized folks. Maybe in a century or two we can do it, but in the meantime, we will send them out to this place we'll call Indian Territory, and they can live in this segregated space, and we can have the rest of the land.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Claudio Sont. He is the author of the book Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. Was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2020, and was also the winner of the Bancroft Prize in 2021. Claudio Sont is going to be involved in my home radio station's KPFA event tonight. And what's great about these events during the pandemic, the pandemic's not great, but what's great about the event is that you actually don't have to be in the Bay Area to be able to participate, because it'll be done online. And so tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Claudio Sont, and I can already tell I wish I had 2 hours to talk to him right now, because we're only going to scratch at the surface of this story. Well, he is going to be joined by my colleague, Mickey Huff of Project Censored, tonight at 6 p.m. on a KPFA-sponsored event. And if you want to participate, if you want to view that event, you could do so by going to the radio station's website, kpfa.org. On the front page, there are events. Just look for Claudio Sont. Click on the link and sign up so you can watch tonight's conversation. And you can also ask your own questions to Claudio Sont. Claudio Sont, tell me more about Andrew Jackson. He's elected president in 1828. He lost in 1824, controversially. We've talked about these things when we talk about the Electoral College. We'll put that to the side because our time is limited. But in 1828, was he campaigning for the expulsion or deportation of Native people in the southern eastern portions of the United States? And what was the movement around this for such policies?
So he doesn't have to explicitly campaign for expelling Native peoples, because because white Southerners, especially, they already know him as a war hero. Now, he was a war hero because of his victory over the British in the Battle of New Orleans in 1814, but he's also a war hero because he slaughtered the Creeks in the Creek War of 1813 and 1814, culminating in this battle of Horseshoe Bend, which really was just a massacre in which some 800 Creek women, children, and men were cornered in a bend of the Tallapoosa River and shot down. Some of them tried to escape by swimming across the river, but Jackson had stationed troops on the other bank, and they shot these people as they were swimming. So he was a land speculator. He was a slave owner. He was sympathetic to what he thought of as the plight of white men in the South. So they knew what his feelings were about Native peoples. He was contemptuous of them. He thought that a treaty was a farce, not an agreement that the United States, between two sovereigns, that the United States ought to honor. But he said it was just a piece of paper to keep Native peoples happy in the short term, there was no obligation on the part of the United States to honor these treaties.
Just wanted to quickly interject. He ignored a Supreme Court ruling saying that the United States had to, and it's a controversial set of rulings, I understand that, but part of it was that the United States had to abide by a treaty with the Cherokee Nation. And I think it's apocryphal. I don't know if he actually said this or not, but something to the sense of, he said, Chief Justice John Marshall made his ruling. Let's see him enforce it.
Right. It appears those words may have been apocryphal, but largely irrelevant, because the important point here is that he did disregard what the Supreme Court said. So there were a series of Supreme Court rulings. These were generated by indigenous opposition to dispossession, especially led by the Cherokee principal chief, John Ross, who was very savvy, familiar with the halls of power in Washington, D.C., spent a lot of his time there, knew how things worked, and hired lawyers to take this case to the Supreme Court. And there were two Supreme Court rulings in 1831 and 1832. The second one, Worcester v. Georgia, was in essence a victory for the Cherokee Nation. And it said that the state of Georgia had no right to extend its laws, its sovereignty over the Cherokee Nation. So he and other Cherokees thought of this as a complete victory. The only problem was that the man at the top of the executive branch, Andrew Jackson, ignored it. And so these state laws that Georgia passed, and other Southern states did the exact same thing, Alabama and Mississippi, extended these laws over Native peoples, and then didn't give them the right to testify in court. And so basically just declared open season for white citizens to squat on indigenous lands, to steal their property. There was nothing that Native peoples could do. So state law became an instrument of oppression, and it became the tool by which these states were able to dispossess Native peoples who did not want to leave.
I want to talk about how the Cherokee Nation tried to resist these policies, and you've already started talking about them by bringing this case to the courts. And it's always complicated when you talk about any particular group of people, because you have different factions who believe that they should do different things. And that was very much true for the Cherokee Nation. But the Cherokee Nation was sort of considered the shining star example of civilization. They basically did everything that the United States asked them to do up to this point before they were deported from their own land. But I specifically wanted to talk about their resistance and the role, because my interest was piqued by their newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix. And you write a lot about this in your book, and it was really interesting. Can you tell me about their newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix, which was published both in English and in their own language, the role of what that paper had during this period of time?
Right. So there are indigenous leaders across the country who are fighting this policy, but probably none as effectively as the Cherokees. And that's for a lot of reasons. But in part, it's because a number of their leaders were fluent in English. In fact, their first language was English. And John Ross, whom I already mentioned, was just extraordinarily wise to the ways of U.S. politics and a gifted writer, and could write circles around Andrew Jackson. So I mentioned this Jackson's propaganda campaign earlier, and one of the frustrations for Native peoples was some way to counter all of this disinformation that was being spread to U.S. citizens. The seat of power in the United States was between Washington, D.C. and New York City at the time. And most U.S. citizens by the 1830s had never seen a Native person. They were not familiar with them. And so it was fairly easy for cynical politicians to tell them, oh, these Native peoples live in squalor, they're all alcoholics. Their numbers are diminishing rapidly. They will disappear if we don't do something about it. They are all hunters. They don't know how to farm. None of this was true. And so Native peoples would read this in the newspapers, and they were extraordinarily frustrated at their inability to combat this disinformation. So that's where the Cherokee Phoenix comes into play. It is the first indigenous-operated, indigenous-language newspaper in the Americas. It's founded in 1828. There, half of it is in English, half is in the Cherokee syllabary, which is invented a few years earlier by this amazing Cherokee polymath from the Eastern Tennessee, Western Cherokee Nation, named Sequoia. And so they start printing these articles saying, well, you know, over and over again, in fact, it's not the case that we're diminishing. Our numbers are stable or even growing, which, by the way, looking at it from my perspective today, I think was true. The best evidence suggests that their numbers were growing. So they printed these articles, and they were picked up and run by newspapers throughout the North, not in the South, because white Southerners did not want to hear the words of the people they were oppressing. And these were the most moving and eloquent, expressions of the degree of oppression that was being waged by white Southerners. And so they didn't want, obviously, for these voices to be picked up and disseminated. But in Northern newspapers, these articles are printed and reprinted. And so what it does is to generate a fervent opposition to dispossession among white Northerners. And it generates the first massive petition campaign to Congress against dispossession. These petitions were written by the hundreds and signed by thousands and thousands of white Americans, and they flooded Congress. And in fact, the legislation itself, the so-called Indian Removal Act, passes by a mere 5 votes in May of 1830 out of 199 cast. So it really just barely makes it through this Congress that was overwhelmingly Jacksonian.
I think this is important to talk about, because when we do we've done a lot of shows on the 19th century in U.S. history, and usually it's about slavery, and usually it's about this divide between North and South. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying it, but and people who fought against slavery, including white people who fought against slavery, people like John Brown, Henry David Thoreau, can go down the whole list. Charles Sumner, obviously, Thaddeus Stevens, but I'll stop there. What I've always wondered is what we don't hear as much about are these policies towards removing indigenous people from their land in the South. And what I got from your book, again, you mentioned a very close vote in the House of Representatives on this bill that passed in 1834 removal, 102-97. What was that debate like in this country?
Observers said it raised the debate in Congress to a fever pitch. Observers said they had never seen that much tension and anger on the floor of Congress up to that point. What's really interesting about this is that there's this structural advantage that the South has. And I keep talking about the South here because I think it really is a Southern piece of legislation. And in fact, Martin Van Buren, who becomes Jackson's vice president, said explicitly that this was a Southern piece of legislation. But there's this structural advantage which was built in to the United States in the U.S. Constitution. It's the notorious three-fifths clause, which gave the South in Congress in 1830 an additional 21 votes, right? Because the three-fifths clause says we're for purposes of representation in Congress, we're going to count all the free people, and then we're going to count everybody else and multiply by three-fifths and add that to state representation. So it's these extra 21 votes that make the difference in this really critical vote, which was a turning point for Indigenous Americans, and I think for the United States too, more broadly.
This is where we see a familiar pattern of the South enforcing itself with these rules.
It is an old story and an ongoing story, and no longer with the three-fifths clause, obviously, but with other procedural tools that Congress and Southern representatives and senators can wield.
It's interesting because I think about this North-South divide on this issue, which I hardly ever hear being talked about in this way, you know, the way we talk about it concerning slavery. And then I think of the birth of the Republican Party. Now, we're a couple of decades later than the story you're telling in the 1850s. And the Republican Party was born to take on the slave power, but they were also considered free soilers. And oftentimes what's lost in this conversation about the fight between the Republican Party or the North and the South over slavery was this was about expanding the United States westward and whether or not these states would be slave states or not, which usually is left out in that equation is, well, wait a minute, what about the people who are on that land to begin with?
Right. And so this is, you know, this is this central difference between the dispossession of Native peoples and this kind of sectional divide between North and South over slavery. That essential difference is that both white Northerners and white Southerners wanted land and wanted indigenous land. And so you could be a white Northerner and want indigenous land, but be against slavery because you didn't want enslaved folks working on that land, because in essence, then those laborers would replace you. So that is this kind of central divide, and I think goes a long way to explaining why the disposition of Native peoples is the war that slaveholders won, as they say in the book, and the Civil War is the war that they lost.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting dynamic. Were there white people in the North who fought for, in the political realm, for indigenous people, the way that you would see for trying to end slavery?
So, obviously, it never comes to a point where they're taking up arms. But in the 1820s, as Georgia politicians are pushing this issue, the rhetoric is extreme on both sides. So, but it originates first with these planter politicians who say that, so this is kind of mid-1820s, late-1820s, the federal government is saying, look, you need to abide by these treaties that we've signed with the Creek Nation, and state politicians in Georgia are threatening to shoot at federal troops. And if you read through newspapers in Georgia in the 1820s, they're full of just overheated opinion pieces sent in by planters saying, we need to man the bastions. We need to defend, we need to defend the right to our land. And that's what they call it, our land. And by that, they meant Indian land. And the right to our slaves. And they see these issues as being conjoined, because if the federal government, they're both threats to white supremacy in essence. So they say, we'll go to war. We will meet federal troops on the border of the state if we need to. Now on the other side, you do see white Northerners who, you know, how serious they were, I don't know, but who say, you know, look, if they want to take up arms, we'll be happy to meet them on the field of battle. But again, it doesn't come to that. Southern politicians push this almost to the brink, and then they're able to get their way in Congress.
Talk to me about the economics of all of this. At the time, the southern eastern portion of the United States is considered to have the most fertile land, if not in the country, perhaps even of the world at the time. Is that what they wanted? Was they wanted that land for agriculture?
Right. They are looking, casting their eyes west. These planters imagine that they will dominate the Union, but that's not all they want. They imagine that eventually they will expand this empire of slave labor camps all the way to the shores of the Pacific, down into Mexico, across the waters in the Caribbean. They'll take Cuba too, they think. This is going to be an empire that will last for eternity and dominate the world, and they're going to sit at the top of it. That's their fantasy, and they make no bones about it. They're proud of it in the 1820s and 1830s. So there's a lot of money being made. What I discovered in the course of doing research for the book is that Wall Street got involved. Because they recognized that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make just unparalleled profits. If you could seize this land, again, some of the most valuable agricultural land in the world at the time, if you could get hold of it on the cheap and turn it around, you were stood to make a lot of money. So every leading Wall Street investor gets involved in this. They form these joint stock companies, and they start speculating in indigenous land in the South. And in fact, you can trace this speculation across the Atlantic. There are investors and brokerages in England who are also getting involved, and I think in continental Europe as well. So that's one side of the story. The flip side is that Native peoples are dispossessed of this land, and there are ways to calculate this. I did some very conservative calculations, which suggest that it was the equivalent of dispossessing, take one nation, but this applies to others as well, the Choctaws, the equivalent of dispossessing the Choctaws of one of the most valuable corporations in the United States today. So that's how much wealth was stolen from them in the 1830s.
Any of these investors we'd recognize today? I mean, I think of when we talk, you know, we look at slavery and insurance companies, there are some that are still around today that we can trace.
Yeah, the names won't resonate today. There's one fellow in particular, J.D. Beers, whom I follow. He was really sat at the very top of Wall Street in the 1830s, but we don't know him today. His son-in-law, a man named Curtis, became the head of a bank. He also profited handsomely from the speculation. He became the head of a bank that later was subsumed into Citibank. This wealth kind of accumulated over the generations. It still existed in the 20th century. Again, on the flip side, the dispossession had consequences, I think, that resonated for generations in indigenous families.
How does slavery play into this? Does slavery follow because it is agriculture, or is this also purposefully meant to expand slavery?
Slavery is right at the core of it. And the profits generated by Northern investors and Southern planters from these slave labor camps, it sits right at the core of this story, because again, it's this land, it's this the Black Belt, you know, which we use to describe this very dark arc of soil, which crosses right through the heart of the Creek, Choctaw, and Chickasaw nations, and planters wanted to gain access to this land. So it's right at the core of the story.
A main point in your book is that it didn't have to happen this way. And I think when we think about this history with indigenous people generally, we could obviously say that all of this didn't have to happen. But you mean very specifically in a way that the United States still would have been the United States without this mass deportation of people from the South.
Well, I wanted to get away from this sense of inevitability in writing this book and to underscore that it was a political act. And there were voters, all white men at the time, who went to the polls to put politicians in Congress and in the White House who supported this policy. And there were folks in Congress who voted for it. And again, it didn't have to pass. Certainly, indigenous politicians didn't think there was anything inevitable about it. And they fought to the very last moment trying to resist. They recognized certainly the immense pressures they were under and the difficulties that existed if they were to remain on their traditional homelands. But they also thought they saw a path forward. And so I don't think we should dismiss or underestimate the degree of their creativity in trying to work something out had they not been dispossessed in the 1830s. Who knows how these political relationships would have evolved in the 1840s and 1850s. And certainly the United States was then preoccupied with other business, with this sectional divide over slavery in the 1840s and 1850s. So there's certainly a kind of plausible counter scenario that we could imagine. But again, I think just it's important to underscore, we don't want to dismiss or underestimate the ability of indigenous politicians to work something out and to be able to negotiate and compromise in some way that would have allowed them to stay on their lands.
Do you think what happened in the 1830s set a precedent for what would happen throughout the rest of the century with the dispossession and really genocidal acts towards Native people all the way to California?
Yeah, so we noted earlier on that this story of dispossession is old, and acts of violence and even genocide are old as well and long predate this policy. But what I think it I do think it's a turning point for the United States and for Indigenous Americans. And I think we can see that it remade the geographical relationship between the United States and Native nations. So in 1830, there are indigenous nations within the boundaries of the United States. And by 1840, there are some exceptions, but by 1840, for the most part, and certainly from the perspective of white Americans, Native peoples no longer existed within the United States. They were on the outermost, westernmost advancing edge of the nation. And Congress said this, they are on the outside of us now. They are on the outside. And so I think what we see unfolding over the rest of the 19th century and this vicious genocidal Plains Indian Wars in the 1860s and 70s and 80s, culminating in the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890, I think that's an unfolding of what happens in the 1830s, of the remaking of this geographical relationship.
Claudio Sont has been our guest. He is the author of the book that we have been in conversation about. It's called The Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. It was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2020 and winner of the Bancroft Prize for 2021. The good news is we could have gone another hour, but Claudio Sont will be doing another couple of hours probably tonight at a KPFA-sponsored event. That's my home radio station. And the good news about being in a pandemic, if there is good news, is that with our KPFA events, anyone can participate and join the event online. So it starts tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You go to our website now, kpfa.org. On the front page, you'll find our events section, and then you'll see Claudio Sont, and you click on that, and you register for tonight's event that starts at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. He'll be joined by my colleague and friend, Mickey Huff of Project Censored. Claudio Sont, I found that very important and very interesting, and I thank you for taking this time to join us today.
Thank you, Mitch. It was a real pleasure.